Psychots have a cult following, some costing collectors tens of thousands of euros. These plants are incredibly rare, with 95% of the 300 plus species currently threatened with extinction, despite international laws governing their harvest or trade. So it's very exciting news that this prehistoric tropical plant has produced male and female cones in this part of the world for the very first time in 60 million years. Two cycads have in fact produced cones of both sexes on the cliffs of a botanic garden in the Isle of Wight. The island is warmer than most parts of the UK, only the Isles of Scilly have a higher temperature, and botanists are saying that this is another clear indication of climate change. Chris Kidd is curator at Ventnor Botanic Gardens, and I spoke with him earlier and asked him about these two plants and how they came to the attention of everyone there.
We've been growing unusual plants that are subtropical, the plants you wouldn't normally be able to grow out of doors in the UK at Ventnor for 30 years, and we try to push the boundaries of things that you wouldn't expect to be able to grow, and cycads are a great example of that. They come from a part of the world. Very few places left. These particular plants are from Japan, and they're the sort of things which would normally be grown as house plants. So we put them outside speculatively about 18 years ago, and this year they've produced cones for the first time out of doors. We have a male plant and a female plant, and this is the first time that this will have happened in this particular part of the Isle of Wight since cycads grew here 60 million years ago, which we know from fossils which have fallen out of a cliff nearby to where the garden now is.
So these are quite specific in terms of the conditions that they require before they start going to produce the cones. And is that your evidence that there's climate change affecting the particular area you're in at the moment?
Indeed. Just to be able to grow these plants out of doors is quite an achievement, because the temperatures they need to be in excess of warmth above zero, ideally above 4 or 5 degrees Celsius for long periods of time throughout the whole year. In order to produce new rosettes of leaves and produce cones, the temperatures during the summer months have to be in excess of 21 degrees for a prolonged period, about 3 months. And historically, these sort of conditions haven't been available anywhere in the UK. But where climate is changing, Ventnor Botanic Garden sitting in a very mild microclimate, we've had the conditions now been upon us, and this has happened.
And just to appreciate how old a species they are, these would have been the staple diet for some dinosaurs.
Yes, when the dinosaurs were on the planet, it was before flowering plants had come onto the scene. And the dominant flora that would have been seen across the whole world is much more like the plants that you would see or refer to now as conifers or ferns. And cycads were amongst that group. They were non-flowering plants. And they would have been a dominant plant on the whole of the planet, and they would have indeed been feasted on by the herbivorous dinosaurs.
Chris Kidd, thank you for joining us from the Isle of Wight.
Pleasure.
That was Chris Kidd, curator at Ventnor Botanic Gardens in the Isle of Wight, speaking to me earlier. Well, just how significant is this development in the botanic world? Matthew Jebb is director of the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. You too must have mixed emotions on hearing this particular bit of news, Matthew.
Exactly. It's another example of how climate change is ever present now. I know that in Dublin we have got cycads growing out of doors on Hoth Head, so they are mild enough out there to survive. In the Botanic Gardens itself in Glasnevin, we have occasional winter frost, so we haven't actually been brave enough to risk any of our plants out of doors. And as was explained there, that cycad takes a long time. We have some cycads that are 100 years old, and they have still to produce their first cone. And of course, as male and female plants, the timing of this has to be exact. They both have to appear at the same time. And then the pollinator, which in the wild would be a little beetle, usually a weevil, with an extraordinary huge long rostrum, this extraordinary long mouth part, and they would transfer the pollen from one cone to the next. And the process is that if a weevil wants to bump into a weevil of the opposite sex, the best place to find such a companion is in a cycad cone. It's a nice warm place. Cycad cones actually warm up. They are dark. They're attractive in that you can avoid predators. So you can meet up with other beetles there. And this is the process of whereby these beetles became attached in a relationship with the cycad plants. And today, some cycad species are down to no more than a few dozen individuals. And it appears that the beetles have long since gone extinct. So once the species has shrunk to a point where there's no available habitat for these beetles to live, they have disappeared, and therefore these plants are now bereft of a pollinator.
So this is not so new as all of that. It's just a coincidence that this time the two have got their cones at the same time. You get a male an odd time, you get a female an odd time, but now, you know, now the two have happened at the same time. Is this just a coincidence, or is it actually a malevolent indicator of climate change getting worse by the minute?
It's just that. It is the warming. In the botanic gardens in Glasnevin, we have plants we have been monitoring for close on 45 years now to mark the dates on which the flowers appear, the leaves appear, and when the leaves drop off. And observations in nature as well have revealed that the sort of springtime flowering and leaf production has come forward by many weeks.
But this is ordinary plants, this is not cycads.
It is exactly all plants. So what one can see is the rate of climatic change. And people always talk about degrees centigrade, but actually it's much better to think of it in terms of plants as the zonation. Because if you are growing plants down in Wexford, it's much drier and warmer than, say, Donegal. The spring arrives earlier on the south coast of Ireland. And what is happening, it is as though Ireland is moving southward. So climate change is moving at the rate of 4 kilometres a year, which translates into 12 metres a day is how much the climate envelopes are shifting in this part of Europe.
As slow as a snail.
It's faster. If you were a slug trying to avoid climate change, you've got to move at 12 metres a day in the right direction, which is heading north into the cooler and quieter historic times, if you like.
It just occurs to me, Matthew, that we haven't quite described the plant fully for people listening on radio as against looking at it online or otherwise. And it's often confused with a palm or a fern, but it isn't.
Yes, so a cycad is a seed plant, but it's a conifer, so it doesn't have flowers. It produces a massive cone at its head, but it's a single trunked plant. And it has a lovely big whorl of leaves, a huge set of feather-like leaves at its apex. And there is one plant that we have in the National Botanic Gardens that is a male. He's a male. He's only been found once in history. So he was the sole surviving representative of his species. There is no female. So technically, that wretched plant is extinct, unless a female was to be discovered, and it's looking very, very unlikely now. This South African plant, represented by a single male line, has no companion with which to make baby cycads.
I'm seeing a pattern here in the programme so far of all of these lonely
we'll
heart
all
plants
be ruined
and poor spiders carrying gifts as well.
Presumably you've sent shoots of this off to other botanicals. It's like the Wollemi pine kind of thing, you know. It's doing fine, but in a restricted fashion. Is that the situation?
You're right. Ours is one of about 30 around the world. So these have been produced by little pups from the base of the original daddy plant, but it is our duty, if you like, to say, well, what could we do to bring this back? And one project that's being tried is to hybridize it with the closest living relative, a different species, and we already have babies growing up which are half of this father plant, if you like, and a surrogate mother. So they're hybrids. They're only 50% of the original plant, which is known as Encephalatus woodii. We can call it Woods cycad. And these hybrid Woods cycads will be back-crossed with dad in the mm-hmm. future. They'll be back-crossed with granddad, with great-granddad. And in about 400, 500, 600 years, we will have offspring that will be, if you like, nearly 90% of Encephalatus woodii, but they will be female. So in a way, we can piggyback these plants with a closest relative, and one day in the future, we will have a viable plant that could perhaps say that we've brought it back from the edge of extinction.
When do you call, you botanists call it the wooden brain? I think Encephalatus would be a woody.
Yes, it's because it produces a big cone. It looks like a huge head on the top of a narrow upright body. So that's where the name originally comes from. But they were exploited by people as a source of starch, so you can chop out the interior of these plants.
I did mention at the beginning that there were some famous collectors, David Bowie and a couple of other movie stars. Brad Pitt is another one as well. What's the attraction for collectors? And $50,000 for one plant I saw as well online when I was having a quick look at them.
The great irony is, you know, the rarer something is, the higher the price on its head. And the great auk is a wonderful example of how human greed can lead to the extinction of a species. The great auk, you know, one of our big, it was the penguin of the north, if you like, an auk that grew to a huge size such that it couldn't even fly. But the last eggs of that species were hunted by museums because they wanted one for their collection. A great tragedy, and it's happening today with plant species all around the world, that a high price is put on its head and people hunt it down. Recently, I've been working on a group of plants, which are the pitcher plants of Southeast Asia, and the trade in that is worth hundreds of millions of dollars a year. And looking at the price on the individual species, the rarer the species is, the higher the price. It's a very, very simple measure of what our foolhardiness is leading to.
Tulips in Amsterdam come to mind.
Yes.
The black tulip.
Well, the fires that have engulfed the Amazon rainforest, the largest land-based carbon sink on the planet, remind us of the fragility of our ecosystem and the importance of looking to other carbon stores. The ocean's role in halting climate change has never been more clear. But did you know that a simple submarine plant captures carbon at up to 35 times faster than tropical rainforests? The plant is seagrass, but it too has suffered a steep decline in recent decades caused by pollution, runoff from the land, coastal development and damage from boat propellers, with up to 92% of seagrass having disappeared in UK waters alone in the last century. Well, one project is looking to reverse this decline. Sky Ocean Rescue, the World Wildlife Fund and Swansea University are together launching the biggest seagrass restoration project ever undertaken in the UK. Well, Dr. Jenny Oates is UK Sea Programme Manager with the WWF and is in Cardiff. Jenny, welcome to the programme.
Hello there.
What can you tell me about seagrass?
Yes, well, seagrass is really a wonder plant. So it's a flowering plant that grows under the sea, forming underwater meadows, which are absolutely full of life. So seagrass provides a habitat for animals like seahorses and pipefish, which are a kind of fish that's closely related to seahorses, and they hide in the fronds of the seagrass with their long bodies. It's also a home for animals like crabs and baby cuttlefish. And importantly, seagrass provides a nursery habitat for young fish that we like to eat, so species like plaice and cod. And seagrass can actually provide a home for 40 times more animals than bare sand alone. So it's really important as a place for marine wildlife to live. But also, really importantly, seagrass is really great at capturing carbon. So it can capture carbon at a rate 35 times faster than tropical forests and store it in its roots and sediments. So this is another reason why seagrass is really an amazing plant.
And what distinguishes it from seaweed?
So it's a different kind of plant from seaweed. It's a flowering plant and it has bright green leaves, and the seagrass seeds grow in these in the long blades of the grass, and these are the parts that we can harvest in order to be able to collect them.
Why has it declined so much, Jenny?
Well, seagrass is under threat from issues like poor water quality, so runoff from the land, from human pollution and agricultural runoff. It also gets damaged by boats from their propellers and anchoring, and some kinds of fishing can cause damage to seagrass too. And also, in the past, coastal development has been a big issue, clearing areas of seagrass beds. So it's actually declined by up to 92% in the UK in the last century. And globally, we lose an area the same size as two football pitches every hour. So really, governments haven't been doing enough to protect the seagrass that we have.
Whereas it grows in very shallow water because it needs light, and light, the proper rays of light for photosynthesis can't penetrate very far. So you're looking at really the first 10 metres of water where your seagrass will actually grow. So it's obviously very close to the coast, very close to where pollutants and everything else come out.
Exactly. And that's the reason why it's so vulnerable, really, to runoff from the land. And particularly if there's issues with the water quality, it means that the light can't get through to the leaves of the plant, and so it can't grow properly.
We have a seagrass in Dublin. In Malahide Estuary, there's one, Zostra augustifolia. And there is said to be a clump of it on the Bull Island, but I have never seen it. Now, if you read about Brent geese, for instance, it's said that back in the 30s, 20s and 30s, there was ample Zostra around, and the geese feed on this. Why should it be such an enormous decline in a few decades? I mean, well, the pollution hasn't increased that much after all, and boats aren't tearing it apart. It seems an extraordinary collapse. Can you explain that?
Yeah, well, I think governments haven't necessarily always been aware about the extent of the decline of seagrass. So I think it's an issue that's gone unnoticed for quite some time. I think people are starting to realise the importance now, and it's not too late to start protecting it. But we really need to act now to protect the seagrass that we have.
But presumably, if people inadvertently are damaging it, we would actually need to survey where it is, designate these areas as protected, so people with boats and that will have routes out and in, so that they're not willy-nilly going through unknown beds because they don't know they're there.
Absolutely, yeah. So it's a combination of both, really. So we need to make sure that we protect the seagrass beds that we already have, and make sure that the government does this effectively. But also, if we're working to restore areas of seagrass beds, we need to make sure that those areas that are restored have the proper management in place to protect them.
Why should it be such a good carbon storage plant? I mean, where is the carbon actually going? I mean, there aren't massive tree trunks at the end or huge roots running through the, as there would be, say, in the rainforest or something like that. Where is this carbon going, and how does it come to be locked in the seabed?
Well, it's really interesting. So the seagrass, the blades of grass absorb the carbon dioxide from the water, and then they store this into the seagrass roots, but also the seabed sediments. So it's not actually just stored in the plant itself, it's actually going into the seabed. So this is a really different way of actually capturing carbon, and it can be really fast. So I think I mentioned earlier, it's about 35 times faster than the rate of a tropical forest. So it's a really important means of capturing large volumes of carbon.
So when the seagrass then dies, it being a plant, I mean, it hasn't got timber or anything in it, the actual plant itself might die, but the carbon stored in the sediments will last even if the grass is gone.
Exactly, and that's why it's a really important way of capturing carbon.
So, I mean, the areas where the seagrass was and no longer is, are the sediments still in the seabed underneath that, or have they gone too?
I guess that previously when those seagrass beds were in existence, they were capturing the carbon and that will still be stored. But in those areas where we no longer have the seagrass, or we have much less than we used to, we're not able to have that active carbon capturing still continuing. And that's what we really want to see restored, so that we can continue to have this function of capturing more carbon over time.
And will this alleviate the reduction of the Amazon rainforest, or are we comparing David and Goliath here? In fact, given that you can only have 0.2% of the seabed as suitable terrain for this, because it has to be in very shallow waters, I mean, is that area anything comparable to what a rainforest in the Amazon might hold?
Well, it's a pretty small area that is possible to do to restore seagrass, but the amount of carbon that it can capture is huge. So you can restore a fairly small area. So the kinds of areas we're looking at for this pilot project is only around 2 hectares. But that can capture a huge amount of carbon because of the high rates at which it can be stored by the seagrass. So we don't necessarily have to restore huge areas for the volume of carbon that can be captured. So the ocean's role in halting climate change is actually becoming much, much more important.
I think the important thing you're talking about here, Jenny, is this stability that one's restoring. Because if you think of a mobile sand beach, it's very unstable. It gets washed around and moved. If you have an existing seagrass bed, it mats it all together. The geese may be here browsing it in the winter, but in the summer, it's able to grow and develop all its rhizomes. The real problem for an eelgrass is it finds it incredibly difficult to establish a new stable bed. And your project of, you know, literally pinning down little seedlings in Hessian sacks will be, you know, a revelation to a method, a means by which we can restore Zostera seabeds here, because they will go quite deep underwater, but the point is they stabilize the sand, and all of that carbon, the rhizomes, the whole ecosystem then becomes stabilized, and it is resistant to being damaged by erosion.
Dr. Jenny Oates, UKC's program manager with the WWF, thank you for joining us on Mooney Goes Wild. And that is our programme for today. My special thanks to Eanan Ilana, to Dr. Richard Collins, and to Matthew Jebb, the director of the National Botanic Gardens in Dublin. Thanks to Sheila Neville on sound, broadcast coordinator Jarlath Holland, the researcher John Riley, our producer is Sheila O'Callaghan. And the programme is back tomorrow evening at 10 o'clock. And indeed, Derek will be back with you as well next week too. From me, Michael Cummin, thanks for listening.